from runasradio.com. You're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 298 with guest Bruce Adamczak, recorded Monday, December 17th, 2012. Run As Radio is produced each week by Quap Productions, providing professional media and podcasting services online at pwop.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and welcome to the 2013 edition of Run As Radio. Yep, we're in the new year again, and I'm off and rolling with another set of shows, 50 more for 2013, and thanks so much for listening. My guest today is Bruce Adamczak, and he's a senior premier field engineer at Microsoft. He joined Microsoft in May of 2002 and is based in Columbus, Ohio, supporting customers in the Heartland District and around the world. Adam is a platform specialist focused on infrastructure, Active Directory, and performance, and he spends a lot of time defending the Active Directory realm, identifying and resolving issues with enterprise applications, communicating with Active Directory. And you can check out his blog at aka.mslearn2012, which includes 30 days of learning Server 2012. Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Do you need to defend Active Directory? I mean, hasn't it made its statement? It's been, what, 15 years?
Active Directory is always blamed for everything, or at least what I find in my environment is the AD team where I'm working with and the customer I'm working with has a really high caliber team, and whenever there's a problem, they blame Active Directory. That way they get that team involved to go troubleshoot their issues for them.
Interesting. And it's just the apps need to depend on Active Directory for certain amounts of information.
Correct.
Think about the robustness of an AD infrastructure from the point of view of a machine can be rebooted, stuff can go down, and everybody can still log in. But in terms of performance for an app, that's another thing entirely.
Absolutely. I am starting to see all sorts of third-party apps come into the environment that want to use Active Directory as a repository.
Mm-hmm.
Some of these apps, very well written. Others, you can tell they were thinking of a single domain in a single forest.
Right. And are they actually writing to it or just reading from it?
Typically reading from it.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't run into too many apps writing to it.
Right.
I've come across one where it was a in-house custom develop application that was managing groups, and they just totally did not understand how to write LDAP or how to use LDAP, and it just devastated a set of servers.
Is there much documentation around the right way to communicate and work with AD?
There's documentation up on MSDN, but I wouldn't say there's a lot of good documentation or a lot of good examples.
Yeah. This sounds like a great white paper. So like you're going to work with Active Directory as a developer, here's what you should know and here's some good things to do.
Oh, a lot of it comes down just to the basic knowing how to write queries.
Mm-hmm.
And some people just don't know how to write a query.
Right. And it's really not all that different. So you did 30 days of talking about Server 2012?
Yep. Like all engineers at Microsoft, we have to stay current.
Mm-hmm.
So I decided to do a 30-day straight quest and see if I can learn what was new in 2012. And I was absolutely amazed at the end of that quest, what I learned, how much stuff we packed into this product.
It's overwhelming. I was saying 30 days doesn't sound like enough because I'm nowhere near getting through everything that's in there.
Yeah, 30 days was enough to say I could stand in front of a customer and discuss any of the new features and
right.
be comfortable with it. I won't say I'm going to be able to sit down and design it.
Yeah.
I can troubleshoot it. It just is amazing what we packed into the product.
For sure. And let's talk a little bit about DHCP, because I know you did a whole section on that. And this is one of these protocols that just never seems to get fixed.
Fixed how? I don't think it's broken.
But, there's barely any difference between DHCP circa 1996 and today.
Now, that's a true statement. We just really haven't spent a lot of time keeping the product current and up to date and really adding new features to it. And in 2012, we finally did it. We finally stepped up and really have a good story on high availability for DHCP.
Well, that's an interesting statement all by itself, just the idea that we could have high availability. DHCP, it's one of those things that's so simple, most of the time it just works, and when it doesn't, we're all crippled.
Yep, you lose your DHCP server, you're out of luck, nobody's getting IP addresses. A lot of companies don't even think about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just there, it works. When I talk to them, it's like, well, what's your recovery plan? We'll just restore it from backup. It's like, got to have a little bit more than that. How long is it going to take you to get it back up? How long are you going to let your clients live without IP addresses?
So what are we doing different in 2012? What does it really add to us?
Well, 2012 has really done a lot to improve it. In the history, we had really two backup options. Mm-hmm. We had our 80-20 scope option, which wasn't it was a good story, but it wasn't the best story we could have.
And what does 80-20 really mean?
We're going to split the scope between two servers, where 80% is on one, 20% is on the second server.
Right. And so, the main issue being here that you can't have two servers serving from the same set of IP address, from the same scope.
Correct. Right. That was in the legacy world.
Mm-hmm.
In the new world, in 2012, we can actually have a failover relationship, and both servers can serve from the same scope.
Okay, so they are able to talk to each other and know who's served off what address, and when one goes away, the other one just does it all itself.
Yep, the two servers actually have a communication going on in the background,
mm-hmm.
and once you've gone through your DHCP discover, the offer, the request, and the acknowledgement, the client gets its IP address, then the DHCP server turns around and sends a bind update to its partner on what's changed. And then when anything changes in that relationship, the lease is renewed, the lease is expired, a bind update will be sent. So the two servers are actually kept in communication that way.
Nice. Now, does it make sense for these just to be two VMs on separate hardware?
Like in any high availability, yes, you can go at two VMs. Mm-hmm. Yes, you should have them on, you know, separate hardware. That would work just fine.
Right. I mean, DHCP doesn't seem like a ton of work, really, for a machine.
No, it all depends on your environment and how you configured it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, are you servicing 50,000 scopes or are you servicing 10 scopes?
Right.
You know, really, how is your environment configured and how are you using it?
Tell me you've met someone with 50,000 scopes.
I have not met someone with 50,000 scopes. Well, let's rephrase that. I haven't met somebody with 50,000 scopes on a single server.
Right. But, I guess we really should have some of this conversation about just the architectural decisions that you make around DHCP. How far do you go? What kind of isolation are you doing? I don't even want to go into NAP. That's a whole other thing. But, you know, do you have some usual practices? If you get a chance to help someone set up DHCP for something more than 30 machines, what do you talk about?
Well, the first thing I really have to discuss if you're coming into a new greenfield is you really need to understand their routers.
Mm-hmm.
All of the routers are going to have to forward DHCP request messages through the IP helper or through some type of DHCP proxy, depending on whose router you're using. So you really need to understand the type of environment they're in. Is it a branch office deployment? Will set you up in one way? Is it really a regional office type scenario? You might set it up in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have regional data centers? Give you yet a different way you might look at setting up your DHCP servers and how do you want to set up for high availability?
And there's a tendency to want to centralize all of that rather than to distribute it.
Correct. A lot of people right now and a lot of the industry is really in that, let's bring everything back into the data centers as much as possible. Mm-hmm. Let's bring everything back onto VMs as much as possible. And I really don't see a problem with that. And a lot of that has to go do like in a branch office scenario. If we lose our WAN link, does that branch office still need to survive and work?
Right.
If that's the case, how long can they work without getting IP addresses? You know, what's your SLA in that?
Right.
So that's really the business that you have to think about. You know, if the SLA says they have to get an IP address, then I have to have at least a DHCP server with a scope.
Mm-hmm.
At that branch office. Hopefully they're running some type of hypervisor, They got data center. You can bring up a very simple DHCP server, set up a scope, and they're off and running.
Yeah, just a basic range for them to work in. And what are you finding out there? Are people serving up real IP addresses on their DHCP, or is it all just 192.168 or 10 dot something?
A lot of the public addresses are being used out there.
Mm-hmm.
And that really varies on really the company and what they're doing. And does the company actually own an IP address? I really only see the real IP addresses being used at the major corporations that really picked up the IP addresses back in the early 90s.
Yeah, picked up a B-block early on.
Yep. Other than that, I don't see it happening. And even there, the way they've divided up IP out on the internet, they still run into issues even if they have a B-block. Some ISP may be using it.
Sure, yeah. It's hard to control all of that. And yeah, now you get into we're doing DHCP map to NATing and all of those challenges.
Yeah, if I could do Greenfield, I would start with the public IP addresses.
Really? What about IPv6 in this context, or is that a whole other discussion?
That's a whole other discussion if you want to get into IPv6.
No, and not a small one either, but I think it's an important piece of the puzzle, just understanding DHCP and IPv6.
You really don't. IPv6 will take care of itself,
right?
And if you really want to start getting into managing IPv6, that's a whole nother mess and a whole nother conversation that we would have to have.
All right, let's talk about constructing the basic failover mechanism. So, is this clustering? Like, we've got two VMs, or we've got two machines, each going to run a DHCP service. How are they connected to each other?
It's very simple. We're not doing any clustering.
Okay.
So all of the stuff that you knew about clustering, just forget about it. It's a very simple setup. You simply install 2012 on both servers. Mm-hmm. You install the DHCP role on both servers. You set up the scopes on one server. And you can simply then go into the DHCP console. You can either set up a partnership on an individual scope, or you can set up a partnership between two servers.
Okay.
And you simply say, I'd like to set it up. There's a little wizard. You run through it. You can almost click next, 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 and you're set up.
And just runs.
It just runs. We really did a good job getting this set up to run.
Being the high availability guy that I am, once I set this up with two of these things working and get a few IPs out there, see that it's working, I'm going to start working through some failure mode. So pull the network card out of one of the instances or shut one of the instances down. What happens when that happens?
All right. If you just shut one of the instances down, let's assume we set up the failover in the load balance mode, mm-hmm. which means each scope is really load balance trying to handle 50-50 of what's going on.
Right.
And you shut one down, there is a heartbeat that happens between the two servers through a connect message. And if we miss this connect message three times,
right.
the server is going to go into what's called a communication interrupted state.
All right.
In this state, it will start listening for all of the DHCP requests.
Oh, I see. Because normally when they're together, are they sharing, like a 50-50? How's it? They actually have a shared, it's not like one is a master, one's a slave, and the master's serving everything. They're each doing the work.
It's really interesting the way they did this. We create a hash table based on the MAC address that's coming in the DHCP request.
Okay.
And based on that MAC address, each server uses the same hash table, and they know who is going to handle that MAC address.
Right. So they just so you set up a 50-50 rule between them. This sounds like network load balancing.
Yes, a little bit.
Yeah. I mean, it's got the – except until you said MAC address, because network load balancing works like that with setting up rules around IP addresses. But since we're serving IP addresses, we don't have that opportunity to do that.
So correct.
They just set you could just go even odd on the last digit of the MAC address to give a 50-50 split.
We could do that, but the last digit happens to be hex. We
right.
could still go even odd with that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But anyways, there's actually an RFC for the hash table we're using.
So how that rule works. Bottom line is it splits it up. And again, this feels very much like NLB in the sense that both machines know the rules. There's no single point of failure here. And so they are listening on a common IP address or they're both listening to the same spot because, again, we don't necessarily have IPs. And they know who should be responding.
Correct.
So now we go back to, now one of the guys goes away, three heartbeats are missed. He's gone into this communication interrupted state, which means he's recomputed his ownership of the hash table. And if it's only two machines, then he knows I own the whole thing. I should serve everything.
Close.
Oh.
We don't take ownership of the entire scope yet. We'll sit in this communicated interrupted state for an hour.
Okay.
But in that hour, if somebody, for instance, requests a renewal,
mm-hmm.
we will send them an IP renewal, but for a shorter period of time.
Oh, interesting. So just within the like that window of that hour, just in case yep. the other machine comes back up and... Okay, that's cool. That's smart.
And that period of time we call the max client lead time. So it's typically 1 hour. So if somebody comes along, we'll renew them for 1 hour. And if the other server comes back up, everything gets recalculated. The other server knows it's online. It will then renew it for its full lease period again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
If we go past the 1 hour period, we will then go into the partner down mode. At that point, we will take ownership of the entire leases.
So after an hour, it says, okay, well, apparently that guy's not coming back, so it's just me.
Correct.
So this, now, I'm just thinking through why do that extra step? Obviously, to make it easy if the guy's only temporarily down, it's just a patch or something, and they'll be back in a couple of minutes. It's not a big deal to keep running. If we actually go to that full, okay, the partner's down mode, how hard is it to rebuild the cluster again when the guy comes back?
Well, first of all, it's not a cluster.
Right, right. Oh, don't say the C word.
Yeah, don't say the C word. We're not doing clustering. It's not hard at all. When it comes back, it actually has all of its changes queued up,
mm-hmm.
and it will just send all the changes over to its partner to make sure everybody's in sync again when it comes back up.
So it's essentially just keeping a transaction log of all the things I did on your behalf, and then it'll apply them all when it comes back up?
Correct. Actually, it's not even doing it on its behalf.
Yeah.
It's doing it.
It's everything it did.
This is the database now.
Right.
So here's what's changed. It's now your turn to pick up your half of the load.
Right. And the returning machine. Now, so if it was down for 3 or 4 days, the log's just not going to be that big.
It all depends on the number of scopes we're dealing with.
Of course,
again.
Yeah.
You know, if we're dealing with a 50,000 node network.
Yeah, there might be a few changes there. That's a fair number of renewals.
There might be a few changes. And you got to remember, DHCP is being used for a lot more than just your laptop or your desktop anymore.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, people are now bringing in devices from home. People now want their smartphones to get DHCP addresses at work.
Sure.
I mean, we really have to think that, wow, what I used to hand out isn't enough. I'm going to be handing out a whole lot more.
Yeah, it used to be one IP per person, but now that 4 or 5 IPs per person is easy.
Yep. And I'm just thinking in my head, and yeah, I sit at my customer with four of their IP addresses they mm-hmm. hand me.
Yeah, that's just par for the course. And that's not even talking about virtual machines that might need IPs as well. I mean, I've got a Lenovo W520 here with a setup to do system center work. And if you crank it up right, that's 6 IPs out of that machine alone.
Correct. Yep. I mean, we are really cranking out a lot of IPs now.
Which also brings us to a great issue that I've run into, even at conferences, where somebody's got a DHCP server running in a VM, lights it up, and it starts serving IPs to people.
Oh, rogue DHCP detection.
Oh, yeah.
That's always a fun thing. At a conference like that, it may be hard to track them down, especially if they're handing them out on wireless.
Yep.
I'm not even sure how we'd track them down. I can get their IP address. I have tools for that. How do I physically find where that's at?
And where that's actually going on. But even back in, was it 2008, we started getting better tools for just, you know, identifying this is a legitimate DHCP server for the domain.
Correct.
And so, you know, at least your machine would know, okay, well, I'm not willing to recognize that DHCP server. It doesn't seem right.
If the server is domain joined and you install the DHCP role,
mm-hmm.
still to get it to activate, it has to be authorized within Active Directory.
Right.
And you have to have rights to do that authorization.
Okay.
So just your standard operations guy wanting to learn DHCP isn't going to accidentally bring up a box.
Right.
Where the challenge is, and this is going to be exciting, is, all right, I now have my VMs running. I have my own domain running. I've authorized my DHCP server to my own domain.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, I can now be giving out IP addresses if those VMs are out on my network.
Sure. Absolutely.
And that's where things like that happen.
And it just, yeah, then it gets really messy fast because those are, now you have two, you get back to that original issue of I have two machines who don't know about each other that are serving the same scope.
Two machines that don't know about each other serving the same scope is going to be a disaster.
Right. IP
We're going to end up with IP conflicts. Mm-hmm. We do have conflict resolution. Our clients will actually ARP to see if that IP address is in use before they use it.
Mm-hmm.
So in that scenario, if somebody's already using that IP address from DHCP server 1, DHCP server 2, which is a rogue, gives me an IP address that's identical, I will at least ARP on my segment to see if that address is in use. If
right.
it is, I won't use it.
Which is pretty good. And that still depends on a good DHCP design in the first place, keeping given scopes to given segments.
Correct.
Once we start playing with routers and we're across between the router, you could easily serve, if you're allowing that, serving IPs between two different segments, they could both end up with that IP and not be able to see each other until they're communicating across the router. And then light.
My eyes are drifting right now trying to think through that scenario.
Yeah. Well, I've seen it done. You know, setting, we talked about this right at the beginning in the infrastructure piece of this, is that you're setting up DHCP forwarding across the router because you want to centralize DHCP rather than keep separate scopes for separate segments.
Correct.
And a scope per segment is a good idea.
Correct. I'm with you on that. I'm just still trying to, that one scenario you picked up, and I'm just thinking through all the routers, you know.
Yeah.
I can only have one valid IP address on a subnet that routes correctly.
Yes.
With a Microsoft client. Now, that doesn't mean a Unix or a non-Microsoft client is going to ARP and check to see if that IP address
follow the rules properly. Well, and we're living in this bring your own machine to work world where that's why we're serving so many more IPs and all their stacks are different.
Correct. So, yep. Yeah. And everybody does it a little bit differently and...
Yeah, and the rules vary. So it is difficult. So we've talked briefly about how Active Directory affects the DHCP server in the sense that you have to authorize it. But are there other characteristics when you're part of an Active Directory group policies around DHCP?
In the new DHCP, we do have a policy.
Mm-hmm.
That policy has nothing to do with Active Directory group policies.
Okay.
That confuses a lot of people because we use the word policy again.
Yep.
So I really need to stress, in DHCP, the policies we use are not Active Directory group policies at all. They're not stored in AD or anything like that. The policies are stored in the DHCP database.
Okay.
And in these policies, it really allows us to manage how we want to hand out scopes. There's five attributes we use in the policies that allow us to decide who is going to get what. We have our vendor ID class. You have your MAC address, your user class ID, your client ID, and then there's also the relay option 82 ID.
Okay.
So I can actually set up a policy that says this MAC subrange, as you know, every device, the first three bytes, identify the manufacturer of that NIC.
Right.
So I can say, if this NIC is an HTC phone, I can then decide how I would like to grant their scope information. Every device, when it sends a DHCP packet, the actual request within that packet, they also send what's called the vendor ID class.
Mm-hmm.
That may be that it's a 3COM NIC. It may be that it's an IP-based phone. It sends some information in there so I can make decisions based on that. We also have what's called the user class, and this is a user configurable class. You can set it up with ipconfig, and this is where people get confused. I could also set this up using group policies and push this down to clients, and then when a client requests a DHCP address, it will carry this information in it. The client ID on Windows clients is nothing more than the MAC address again.
Mm-hmm.
And then the option 82, when we do that relay forwarding through our routers,
mm-hmm.
I can actually have that router add additional information into that so I can actually know where it's coming from. So I can use all of that stuff together to make some really interesting decisions about how we want to do things.
Yeah, and then we get back to some of those scenarios where I can have a centralized DHCP server, but I know it's coming across a particular router. That router information is there, so I could assign it to a different scope.
Yeah, we could do things like we know this specific segment is only allowed. We really want to secure who's allowed to be on that segment.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I can create, for instance, a whitelist based on MAC addresses, based on option 82.
Right.
So I can whitelist a segment.
That's right down to specific hardware.
Yep.
But it sounds like using these policies, now I can make sure that any incoming iPad ends up in a particular scope, or the printers are all in their own scope, that kind
yep.
of thing.
And I can put the printers in their own scope, and printers don't change their IP address much. I don't
No.
need them updating, you know, every day or every 8 days. I can give those a 60-day lease.
Yeah, very long lease.
But for instance, a smartphone, I may only want to give them a 4-hour lease or
Yeah.
a 2-hour lease.
Sure, because they're so transient. I don't want those IP addresses tied up.
Correct.
And what is the default? Is it a day?
The default, I believe, is 8 days for
eight
a DHCP
days.
If you
yeah.
just go. Another one, which you mentioned earlier, is the virtualization.
Mm-hmm.
People bringing up virtual IP addresses are just chewing them up.
Sure. And they can be very transient if they're not true server VMs.
Correct. All of the VM manufacturers have their own first three bytes that are unique.
Right.
So based on the first three bytes in a wildcard, I can decide how long I'm going to lease you an address, knowing it's a VM on certain segments.
And how do you feel about reservations?
I always need them for dinner. I don't see anything wrong with reservations.
Yeah.
That comes down to a management style and how you wish to be managing your environment.
Sure.
There are some companies that like to have all of their IP addresses reserved.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of work. In 2012, though, guess what? That just became real simple with PowerShell.
Hmm.
Very simple IP address, MAC address, CSV file. I can run it through and add all the reservations in a very simple PowerShell command.
Nice.
I can also, through PowerShell, dump that type of information out of the database. Here are the new leases. They're not reserved yet.
Right.
I can write a little process to reserve them. Or to go through whatever.
Show me the leases that haven't been used in
yep.
in a month.
Type thing. Yep.
Yeah.
So we can do all of that.
Yeah. It's a big thing I have with the reservation process is that hardware dies and you miss. Okay. That machine's gone away. That at Mac is gone. And you've got this reservation sitting there.
Exactly.
So actually catching up with that, you know, having a routine process to go collect up orphan reservations is a good thing. And just sort of finishing that discussions piece off. So then how about fixed IPs in a given subnet alongside scoped DHCP?
That just comes down to a management issue.
Sure.
And that takes us almost into a whole other topic where you really need to start about talking about IP management tools and how you're going to manage your entire IP range of
yeah.
everything you're using. You know, if you're storing that in a spreadsheet, it's good until you close the spreadsheet window, and it's probably out of date.
Yeah.
That's just a management issue to me to
sure.
mix the reservations and static IP addresses. Both work. Microsoft supports both methods.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really just, what is your management philosophy
yeah.
and how are you staffed and do you have your processes in place to really take care of this?
Well, there is an idea that if I between reservations and scoping, the DHCP server in theory would know every IP in use throughout the whole system, which has some merit. It's a one place to look for IP assignments, period.
Correct.
But it does take discipline to manage. Now you're managing Macs, just dealing with the Mac changes on a given server, and you have to deal with that. All right, what next?
What do you mean, what next?
What haven't we talked about yet in this space?
Oh, we've missed all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah? Like?
Let's see. we didn't get too much into the reduction of cost, the way this really does save costs. We don't have to do clustering anymore. Hyper-V, we didn't really get into the two different modes, the load balancing or the hot standby mode. We sort of touched on the different topologies you can set this up in.
So, Bruce, I intended to talk more about the high availability part of DHCP in 2012, but it seems pretty straightforward. Other than that basic failure mode and recovery mode, what else do we need to know?
Well, we have really two modes. We have our load balance mode, which mm-hmm. is a 50-50 split.
Right, and we talked about that.
And mm-hmm. the other mode we really have is the hot standby mode, which is really going to be used in your office deployment or your branch office deployment type role.
Okay.
Where what's sitting in the central data center is the hot standby.
Right.
And it's not going to be handing out any addresses. You don't want it doing anything. But you need it there for high availability in
right.
case your DHCP server at the branch office goes down.
So, and in that mode, then, the active one's in the branch office, and it is sending the log to the standby one over the WAN link steadily.
Correct.
And if that machine takes a header, then you can have the DHCP services served over the WAN.
Exactly. We still have continuity at this point.
Yeah.
You know, the contact messages were going, the bind messages were going. Once those stop, the hot spare then will pick up. It will go into its communication interrupted for, you know, an hour like the other server.
Yep.
It has a 5% pool set aside. So if somebody new comes along, I can give them a lease.
Mm-hmm.
And I know for sure that it hasn't been given out. And then we'll handle that type of failure at that point. When they come back up, we share the database. We go back through all of our bind messages, sharing all the changes that were made. And then the one in the branch office is working again.
Right. And can I do more than just two? Is there, I can't think of a lot of scenarios where I'd need to, but do four servers as part of this?
You could have all sorts of nice topologies depending on how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
They're very simple. It's just two. But what if you have three regional offices?
Right.
You really don't have branch offices. You have three regional offices.
Right. Each with some sort of data center.
Correct. So I could have Office A backing up Office B in a hot standby, Office B backing up Office C in a hot standby,
mm-hmm.
Office C backing up Office A in a hot standby role.
Right, so sort of a ring route.
Exactly. We could set up a nice, pretty ring like that, mm-hmm. each of them backing up each other.
Right. And so the reality is, in a down state, provided the basic connectivity is still available, DHCP is going to be slower, but it's not going to be lost, and it can recover fairly gracefully.
Exactly. You won't lose continuity of being able to hand out IP addresses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that's really the whole goal. Just to make, you know, this DHCP is one of those things that's so invisible when it works. And then when it doesn't work, it's not even first on your list of what's going wrong.
Yep. Most people don't go looking for that rogue DHCP server.
No, that comes much later. Anywhere we should be looking for more information around DHCP in 2012?
Well, you can hit my blog up.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a new URL for you if you just want to get right to DHCP. And it is going to be aka.ms/learn2012DHCP. And that will have some links to some hands-on labs if you want to get your hands on just playing with this and seeing how it works. Some other little white papers, things of that nature, so you can read. And there's also a link. If you're getting ready to migrate, we have some sample scripts on how to migrate split scopes from previous versions onto 2012.
Awesome. Bruce, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Yep. You're very welcome. I enjoyed being here.
And we'll talk to you next week on Run As Radio.